and we got started right away. So welcome, and thank you very much for choosing this session. I know there's a lot of stuff going on here at TechEd, so I want to start with thanking you for picking this session over all the other stuff that you could have gone to and see. So just want to start with introducing myself. My name is Anders Vemmenholt, and I work as a program manager for what we call the Customer Architecture and Technology team, which is under the Windows Server and System Center division. So the reason why we came up with this idea to actually stand up here and tell you about the lessons learned from implementing Windows Server and System Center is that over the past year or so, I've been traveling around in mostly Europe and in Asia to talk to hosters or service providers. They have many different names, but people that drive or host or service workloads or VMs or similar things for their customers. So we're going to talk about a lot of that today. So the background that I have is that we travel around, and I've been talking with about the neighborhood of 10 hosters. And on top of that, we also talk with other hosters that are outside this program. What we helped these hosters doing was that we began with this program last year in September, where System Center wasn't even released back then in SP1. And then as we worked along, we took more and more customers onto the program, and we helped them implement this Windows Server 2012 and System Center into their production environment. So this is actually what this session is about, telling you what we learned from that program. So this also goes back to some of the objectives that I have here. I'll explain how Windows Server and System Center can be implemented at service providers. Of course, talk about some of the challenges that we ran into. And then again, talk about some of those challenges and also talk about how we overcame some of those challenges. So those are the high-level projections. If we look a little bit about on the agenda here, we can see the service providers challenging the data center. That's the first one, just so we set the scene. Some of you might agree with me, some of the perspective, but at least we have a common fundamental to talk from. Then I want to talk a little bit about if you're in the same position, either if you work for a service provider or you are a consultant for a service provider or you interact with them in one way or another. I want to give you some guidance on some of the design patterns that we use in this program. So you, if you're going home and you're considering doing similar things, that you don't have to start from scratch. So that's one of the things I want to do here. But also, and just as important, kind of what the whole session is also about, is to talk about Windows Server for service providers, what we learned. So it's really what we saw out there. And please remember when I talk about these things, it doesn't mean that you are, as I say up here, are more referencing to what we saw. I don't have enough data to say this is a general thing across service providers. I'm more talking about the ones that we work with directly, how they work. And we know there can be many other combinations, but the ones that I'm listing up here. So I'm not saying the world is like that. It's more the ones we talked about. And then, of course, tools to help service providers. This is more kind of tools that we have inside Microsoft or tools that we have other blogs or similar tools that can help you in that journey if you're implementing any of these tools at a service provider that can give you a quick start. And there's some really good things there that I would hope that you would go and take a look at after this session. So earlier today at the keynote, which I assume many of you went to, Brad Anderson talked about the Cloud OS. And there's a new thing because we haven't really talked about the Cloud OS for that long. But what the Cloud OS is really about is that we have three different, you can say, worlds or realms where we have Cloud OSs running today. The key essential here is that we have a consistent platform across. So either if I'm running a VM in my own data center or I'm running VMs at a hoster or I'm running VMs up in the cloud, what I want to have here is a consistent experience either from a GUI or from the underneath tools that I'm using from a networking perspective, from a management perspective, data, identity, and so on. And it really goes down to driving transformation of the data center that Brad talked about earlier today, but also empowers the people-centric IT where I can manage what I want for the things that I'm in control over no matter where they are. But also enabling the modern ads and unlocking the insight to data are obviously drivers that we want to have in here. But this is not new things. Like what we're doing here, what we're offering to people in the data center, in their own data center, what we're offering to service providers is stuff that we already work with. And Brad also talked about it today, where we're learning a lot from our Windows Azure platform for the very high scaling workloads that we have out in the cloud, such as Bing, such as SkyDrive, such as our mailing services, Office 365, and so on. And those learnings are the ones that we want to take from Windows Azure and say, how do we scale such things to the masses and bring them down either into the hoster or into the data center? And you can see some of the functionalities that we're seeing up here, especially multi-tenant environments with isolation. How do we handle that? We can also have policy-based automation, obviously things that you want to drive in a data center. But if we look at this from a multi-tenancy cloud perspective, there are some key requirements that we want to drive here that we saw going from service provider to service provider. And one of the most obvious ones is of course, that we want to isolate between the tenants. And we want to do that in several different ways, but that can also vary from tenant to tenant, depending on their requirement. But in most cases, they want to separate what they have up there. The other thing they also want to do is to do resource metering. And that was also going back to a similar perspective that we talked about today in Brad's keynote, that we charge the right people for the right thing that they utilized at the given point in time, where we announced that we're going to do Azure VMs by the minute. Of course, the service provider wants to do the same thing or similar things, so they actually know how can I automate and prove that a given tenant what they have utilized over the past period of time. Quality of service is another one that we talk to a lot of service providers about. What many service providers are very concerned about is consumption, that certainly one tenant starts to overconsume something that will penalize other tenants that they have in there. And then lastly, of course, VM mobility. That I can take a VM and I can move that VM to any server that I have in the data center without having to think about what boundaries I might be limited upon, such as networking constraints or physical constraints or other constraints, because the more that I can move these workloads around, the bigger my actual computer fabric is that I can spread these VMs out in the data center. So just a quick question to understand who I have in the room. How many of you would consider yourself hosters? Okay, how many of you are consulting or for hosters? Okay, that's one down there. How many of you are service providers, like offering a service, such as VMs or databases? Okay, that's kind of interesting. More than I would have believed, but that's good to know. So there's a new trend that we're seeing, and many of the service providers, when we were out talking to them, talked to us about this, that there is a there's a growing trend that we see. And if we look at what has happened over the past years, we have seen that VM hosting, and I apologize for the green one, I can see it's a little hard to see, and private cloud is kind of getting more and more common. So really what we see here is at the other one, we have price per VM. So it's kind of a limit to how much can I charge for a VM and host it. Then if I say private cloud and I put a little self-service on top of that and I can do a little bit more, I might be able to charge a little bit more on top of what I can do just with VM hosting running in there. If we take that a little further out, I can also extend it with offering simple services running on top of these VMs. So that could be databases, it could be websites, it could be VMs. But this is more like we start to add a little extra functionality on top of providing the VMs. Because really what we call this when we were around talking to the different service providers is we call this the race to the bottom, driving down the cost. So really what the service providers that I've talked to, what we've talked to, are very focused on is to drive down cost. That's one of them. Another concern that they also have, or at least what they see, is that the number one thing that makes them having a closer relationship with their customer is trust. So they say that many of their customers feel a lot more, let's say, secure in the way that if they feel that they can go and talk to a person that they know, and they know that their servers are inside their data center running on that physical hardware, for them there's a lot about trust between the actual tenant and the host or the service provider. They say that's really something that means a lot to their customers, and it's really something that they don't want to jeopardize. So keeping that trust relationship was very important to them at the same time as driving down the cost. Now, so what they're saying is that the further they can move up the complexity of the customer value, the more they can also charge per VM. So what they're saying here is also that, and we can take the example from Starbucks, for instance. Like, at one point, Starbucks must have realized, and I don't know this, I'm just assuming, that there's a limit to how much black coffee you can brew and how much money you can make on that. So at some given point in time, you would have to make additional things on top of that. Either you can go and get a latte, or you can certainly get members of the Starbucks club. So you start providing additional services around that, and certainly I'm not spending a few bucks maybe a week on coffee. I'm spending a lot more, but I'm also getting a lot more, such as music or coupons and stuff like that. And I see some of the similar things going on inside the hosting community there, where many hosts are considering adding this additional value. The other thing, or the other direction that they're also thinking about taking, is what we call system management. So if they have a VM, but they can start providing system management capabilities that customers normally only do in their own data center, such as monitoring, such as backups, such as patch management, you can certainly start to charge a lot more per VM because you're now adding management capabilities on top of this. So these are some of the two trends that we are seeing, either providing more complexity, more customer value, or have more complex workloads running on top of that by that charging more, or we can do that as well as stepping up into the system management space. So talking a little bit about multi-tenancy, what we're seeing here is really the way that we can build cloud computing where the software architecture really takes into account the different ways of building that without jeopardizing it. So some of the things we look at here is data security and privacy. So of course, this is what we also refer to as the Pepsi Coke scenario, where we don't want any tenant at any given point in time be able to have access to another tenant's data. That's pretty logical. But also performance is another thing we need to think about, that if I'm certainly as tenant one, starts to scale up dramatically because, I don't know, I'm selling tickets and everybody wants to go to this concert, then I don't want that performance scale to impact my other tenants. So that's another thing I need to take into account as well. And the same thing really goes for scale. So if I'm certainly growing from 10 virtual machines to 200 in a month, that should also not impact the other tenants. So for that, we actually, when we went out and talked to the different service providers or hosters, what we saw that there was many different flavors in the way that they actually separated the architecture types for the way that they built their data center. So in the first one, they really had really complete silos. And it almost goes back to the old traditional hosting model where you say they can, nobody can ever see each other, and it's physical hardware or it's those VMs running on top of that hardware, and everybody owns their own storage. That one is not so common, but we do see them in some scenarios. Then there's the dedicated tenancy, which we see in some cases, but not that much. That's the one on the lower left. What we do see a bit more often is actually the one above and up the upper right, is where you have tenant, and you have apps, and you have data, and then people share the fabric underneath. That's probably the most common one. How many of you fit into the one I just mentioned? Okay, where you share the fabric across, and then each tenant will then run whatever workload they want to run on top of that. Okay, thank you. Then we have the one at the bottom there where you actually have app data and fabric. This one, I would say, is more typical towards what we see with Office 365 and similar. So some of you might be running number 3 and number 4 at the same time, which I would believe is also getting more and more common, where you provide the workloads on top of that, such as the databases and SharePoint. So the way we really went out and we were building these clouds is that we took a 3-step approach. So the first one is really that we sat down with the host or the service provider here and said, okay, let's start focusing on how we can build or help build the fabric itself, where we talk about how do you want the compute to work, how do you want the network to work, and how should the storage work. And once we came up with a good, complete, solid design, which I will get back to later, then we actually start putting that into a POC environment. Once we once we have a good understanding on how to build that, we took it a step further in the second iteration there, where we then start building the management capabilities on top of that. And I will get back to that as well. But in here, we put stuff in like monitoring, management of the VMs itself with Virtual Machine Manager, and then also, of course, Orchestrator to make sure that we can automate as much as possible in there. And we build that on top of what we call the management cluster. Then at the end, as the third piece, we wanted to go in there and put in App Controller and WAP, Windows Azure Pack, that you saw demoed today by Claire, where here we actually enable people to go in and do the self-service. So that is kind of the three-step approach that we took. And it also seems like a logical way to do it, and also at a speed that the service provider was able to actually follow along. So if we look at the design patterns and the fabric itself, what we want to look at here is really the way we put it together and what patterns we actually use to build up the proven design for every given service provider. So what we understand now, and I don't mind how many of you that already looked at this, is what we call PLAs, or product line architecture design patterns, where we don't want you to start from scratch. So what we start doing right now is we're coming out with design guidance that we refer to as PLAs, where we describe patterns that you can identify yourself with, and you can kind of check mark on a list to say, yeah, that matches my situation, that matches my situation, and so on down that list. And from checking off those things that you can familiarize yourself with, you can actually go in and you can put together a design based on our best practice. And it's really what we want to do here is to talk about, to say, what is it that you need to think about before you sit down and put together this design architecture? And it goes to improving resiliency, high availability, deployment right in the first time. I mean, we want to minimize your time of making all the mistakes that we had to make internally as we were going along trying to learn how to do proper designs. And it has a very structured way of asking the questions and to say, if this is your choice, this is what you need to go and do. So really kind of going with you on that journey, making sure that you make the right decision at the right time, and nothing is kind of looked over or not taken care of. So it's kind of a checklist without trying to do it all at the same time. So down there, you can see some of the areas that we are covering in those PLA guides. So how many of you have heard about the converged, the non-converged, and SMB3 over Ethernet? There's a one hand there, too. There's a little more. Okay, so how many of you have downloaded these guides that are publicly available? That's one. Okay. That means that it's even better that you came to this session because it's going to save you a ton of time going in and reading those guides, making sure that you covered everything. So I really, really encourage you to do that. That is I think it's a 60 pages document that takes you through all those questions. I'm just going to scratch the surface here, but there's a lot of good best practice in there that you want to familiarize yourself with before you get started. So the first one I just want to talk very briefly about is what we call non-converged infrastructure. So the non-converged infrastructure is very similar to what you're probably already running today. You have some SAN, you have some networking, you have a Windows cluster where you have Hyper-V running on top of that. And you connect to your traditional SAN methods. What you see there, you have some SAN storage, you connect with that either by fiber channel or iSCSI, and then you have your hypervisor running in front of that, Hyper-V, and you have your extensible switch and all the VMs running on top of that with VHDs and cluster shared volumes and so on. This is typically what we see people that have already invested heavily in SAN or have not yet moved to a converged infrastructure. They are typically starting with this one. What we also learned is there's a time and a place. What I mean by that is if I go out and talk to a service provider or a hoster, and they just invested heavily in a SAN or some networking infrastructure, I'm not going to say throw out your new investment and throw it out the window and start using this technology. Of course, they want to leverage that investment that they did. So some of them says, okay, for what we have now, we want to use this where we go with the traditional networking, we separate that from the SAN, and then we put up the Windows cluster, and we move on from that, and we use the and we provide the SAN on top of this Hyper-V host using traditional methods. We saw that with I think a little handful of the customers we were out talking to use this model, which is fine. That's nothing. It's really about where you are at a given point in time and what you're ready to do. The next one is what we call converged infrastructure. So converged infrastructure makes use of these advanced blade systems that can use converged technology. And really what it means here at the end of the day is that you see the Hyper-V cluster here. But what you can do with these advanced setup is that you can share storage networking and traditional networking using the same networking underneath. And that's what we see by using NIC teaming, then having fiber channel iSCSI or SMB direct. You can connect directly to your storage using traditional networking infrastructure. Where in the other one we saw before, in here you would strictly separate it where you have fiber channel and then you have networking. Where here you can, for instance, go with 10 gigabit networking, but then you use that 10 gigabit network to share both your storage and your network at the same time. The advantage with this is that you don't have to have as many SAN infrastructure in place, and it drives down your cost, and it also simplifies the way that you run your infrastructure. The last one I want to talk a little bit about what we call a continuous availability over SMB storage. This is a technology that we introduced with Windows Server 2012. It has some very good advantages using this because it has a lot of built-in technology that is not very costly. So if we look at it up here, we have the Hyper-V host, the cluster, that we configure just like we did with the others. But the main difference here is that we use what we call SMB Direct, which makes us capable of using a Windows scale-out cluster, or file cluster, where we can then present our VHDs inside this file cluster, and then the Hyper-V server itself will be able to use that. Now, the cool thing about this is that they will use any network connections that you already have in place. So if you're using 10 gigabits, you can go ahead and do that. But another advantage over this is that you don't even have to team your network cards as you had to do in the other two. And this one, in the SMB stack itself, it would automatically figure out, without teaming, how to use the SMB stack to either if we have a combination, let's say, of a 1 gigabyte card of a 10 gigabit card, it can actually use both of those network cards without teaming them and going over to the file server using the SMB3 stack. The other thing we also have in there is a new technology that was also introduced in Windows Server 2012 called RDMA. Today, I remember, I don't know if you recall, but you saw the VM migration that Jeff did from one cluster to another. And I think it finished this in under 20 seconds, or just about 20 seconds, where the traditional one finished in over a minute. That was because he was doing VM migration using RDMA. So RDMA is a new technology that uses either InfiniBand or IWAP or similar technology that would make your network super fast, both in speed and in latency. So by using this technology, you also get very, very quick access to storage on the back end. What we then have is that we have our file server at the back end where we can then use what we also introduced in 2012, calling storage spaces. Storage spaces allows us to, for instance, attach, we can attach additional SanDisk there, just like we do today, and expose that and use that for to expose or to store our VHDs on that storage. So the other thing we have is that we can also use traditional SAN storage, as I talked about today. If you made an investment in SAN, you can continue using that, but you can put a file server in front of it, and then you can use your VHDs on that file server, and then it would use SMB3 to actually get access to that data. The last one we have is also that we see a lot of our partners or hardware vendors starting to come out with SMB-capable storage, where kind of like you have JBOD today, you can actually go out and buy a similar device that would have SMB built in from the beginning, and you can actually put that on the network, and then you can start using this device between the Hyper-V cluster and the storage device itself and getting the same benefits from that. So if we look a little, if we look at the fabric infrastructure, there's some things that we learned here that I want to share with you today. So just for my network topology, I just want to see a quick of raised hands here. I'm just going to, so, So first one, I just want to see here, how many of you use a mix of 1 gigabit and 10 gigabit network? That's quite a bit of hands there. How many of you use multiple 10 gigabit or only 10 gigabit? That's one guy there, okay. And how many of you use multiple 1 gig only? There's a few there. Okay, that was kind of what I was expecting to see. When we were out there talking to it, they were kind of starting to use 10 gigabit for what they were buying in at right now, and then the older infrastructure had 1 gigabit. We didn't see that many that uses 10 gigabit only. That was mostly if it was by very high performance environments, or there was like service providers dealing with the financial sector or something that had very high workloads. So that kind of matches the group in here from what we were seeing there. So that's good. Thank you for that. So the vast majority of the service providers we were talking to are using VLANs still. So how many of you are using VLANs today? Okay, pretty much. Very few of them were kind of getting to the limit of where they were kind of starting to see performance issues. And I think you can, what they told us was normally they would run into those at around 4,000 VLANs per switch, or at least having 4,000 VLANs in total. Some of them went a little over, but they were starting to see that. But what they also said that they wanted to get away from VLANs because they were having more and more breakdowns in their infrastructure because they made a mistake when they were updating VLANs or getting a new customer in. Because they were actually fiddling with production, and sometimes if they made a mistake, that could have pretty dramatic impact on other customers or people not being able to access certain things. Also, what they told us is that they're seeing more and more customers wanting to be able to automatically take VMs that they have at their own premise and then move it up into the hoster's infrastructure. So by doing that, they actually wanted to exactly what Brad also showed earlier today. Instead of moving up to Azure, they might want to move it to a hoster because they have a bigger trust with a hoster, so they want to be able to better move these workloads back and forth. But what they also wanted to do at the same time is that they wanted to be able to take resources that they have at their own data center to be able to access resources at the hoster's data center so they have a shared network infrastructure. So things like bring your own IP and similar things are definitely things that many of these service providers are thinking about, but they're just not ready to take that step yet, but they definitely want to do it from a strategic point of view. So software-defined networking, as I said, is definitely a way they wanted to do moving forward, but there's also certain things that they were waiting to come. For instance, partner solutions that would enable them to connect the customer to their customers' software-defined networks was one thing that they were waiting for, and we have partners coming up with that, but you would also see announcement this week that would help you enable some of those functionalities. So as you know, with software-defined networking, it's of course that the customer wants to be able to have secure the one tenant from the other, but also some customers said that they also wanted to be able to actually give out the possibility for tenants to create their own networks without having to talk to the service providers itself. But also having it pretty simple and having the flexibility of moving these workloads around. So what we did, as many of you probably already know, with Windows Server 2012, we introduced the SDN solution. What this does is really that it gives you the flexibility that I mentioned earlier to say, okay, you can have this VM running on this server, and I want to be able to move this VM to any host that I have in the infrastructure without having to think about what networks I need to go and update, what switches, what routers, and so on, to move it up there. So we kind of take the whole networking thing and move it up in the software layer instead of moving it away from the physical layer. So the tool that we have to help us apply these policies is really Virtual Machine Manager, where I can say, if I take this virtual machine that has access to these other virtual machines, if I move that over to another host, a virtual machine manager will automatically make sure that those policies would follow that virtual machine, so the switch, the Hyper-V switch running over that other host would automatically get updated with the new information so they can continue communicating with each other. And that gives a lot of flexibility because you don't really have to think about how to customize that lower down in the network stack. So what we also saw here with the networking challenges is also combining LBFO and the Hyper-V switch, where you see here that what we want people to do is really first to create the teaming, then put on the virtual switch, and then on top of that, define your virtual network couch with your virtual networks inside that. What we saw sometimes was really that people were doing this, but it really didn't give the flexibility that we see with virtual switch on top of it. But what you can do here at the other end is also that you have your two NICs here, and then you can let storage and network go through them, and then you can expose the other two NICs here on the other side to use other networking traffic at the host level if that's what you want to do. But if you want to expose the networking to the VMs itself, you should absolutely make use of the VNICs, the virtual switch, and then have the LBFO. It's a lot easier for you to administer, and then if there are certain things you want to be utilized directly by the physical host itself, you can go ahead and do that. So what we saw with networking was also that a failover cluster has really evolved. So in the old days, you really want to have separate networks for the cluster networks, for the external networks, and for the storage networks. But what we see today is that you can really go in and use quality of service inside the cluster itself and start using the same network if that is teamed already, and then you can start saying, okay, I take priority to say the cluster network traffic has the highest priority, then I go down the list to storage or whatever I have further down without having to separate all these networks at the cluster level. You can do that by using that technology. And also, there's a lot of help these days and different ways to set up a failover cluster with the networking configuration that is a lot more resistant. For instance, they can use DHCP and similar technologies to actually use those for the different networks, which makes it a lot more flexible for you to go and set this up. So as I mentioned, a lot of these service providers still use iSCSI, and they might use 2 or 4 1 gigabit network cards in there. We see a few for their new infrastructure, their new purchase hardware, that they have 10 gigabits in those. But as I mentioned earlier, there's always a time and a place where what we're seeing right now is that many hosts says that with 2 to 3 gigabyte adapters, that's really enough to provide enough capacity with the VMs that are running on top of it. So right now, they really don't see a need for 10 gigabit, but they do think in the future that they will come to it and have use of 10 gigabit. So what I'm saying with that is understand what your current use is and try to forecast to say, when will I actually hit 10 gigabit instead of just going out and buy 10 gigabits right away if there's not a current need for it, and then try to capacity or make capacity that will kind of tell you when would be the right time to go out and do 10 gigabit. So just a quick show of hands here again, just doing a quick poll here. How many of you uses SMB3 today? That was not me. Okay. How many of you are thinking about using SMB3? Okay. So maybe if some of you could come up and tell me why you're not thinking about using SMB3, that would actually, we can do that afterwards. I know you cannot ask a question out in a room like this. That would be interesting to know. How many of you are using iSCSI? Okay. And how many of you are only using Fibre Channel? Okay. Does some of the things that I talked about here with Fibre Channel, does that make sense in some of the way that you can move over and use some of these other technologies? Okay. So if we look at the service providers, we talk to really small service providers, and not really small, but with a couple of 1,000 virtual machines. We talk to other service providers that had 50 or 100,000 virtual machines, or maybe even more. So what they're saying here, especially the large service providers, really see a benefit in using SMB3 because they can see very clear cost savings there. Because they can go out and buy a JBOD and they can do direct attached storage and put that on back end of a file server and then put that in a file server cluster and then have the Hyper-V VMs talking to that, they can see they can do that at a very small cost. So they're very interested, especially if they're running very high-scale environments, to use that technology. What we also see, what we thought we would see, if people are using NFS, that we would get a lot of pushback. But for some reason, people really say that this SMB3 makes good sense. There's a lot of good things in the SMB stack itself. If they use RDMA and they have clustering at that layer already, they say there's a lot of benefits that will make them consider SMB3 going forward. And many of them already have it in their first phase scenarios using SMB3. So multi-channel RDMA, they really see some very good performance with that, where they took up some VMs, put it on that RDMA, and they saw like really, really quick, almost faster than the quickest SAN they could get today using that RDMA. So that was quite positive to see that. So the other thing also I want to mention is that the file cluster servers as a front end also kind of helps them limit what they need of SAN infrastructure between the traditional hosts today. So if they just connected the file cluster server to the backend SAN, they could actually save a lot of infrastructure there and just using traditional SMB3 over that. So iSCSI, it's a well-understood scenario. The vast majority of service providers we talked to were using iSCSI, some of them using fiber channel over Ethernet, were also a few. Many of them, some of the design challenge was really how can we use these team adapters and use that with the Hyper-V switch? Because when we were starting counting how many virtual adapters we really needed, when we wanted to team it, we quickly end up with a big handful of NICs that needed to be in the server itself. And we were trying to see how can we really drive that down, and I get to that in a second. Then there's also a little bit of limited use of iSCSI boot support in this scenario, but most of them didn't really do that. They were using the traditional one. So fiber channel itself, not many uses that, and it kind of reflects what you show, what you told me here when you were raising your hands, that fiber channel itself, it is used, but it's not as widespread anymore. Where we see it is mostly where we have premium customers that says we come from a fiber channel background, we want to have that as the host as well. In those scenarios, they went in and used that. And of course, mostly in environments where SAN investments were already in place. So the challenges we are seeing here is that what we learned is that we, in the beginning, thought that any service provider or most service providers were alike. But what we very quickly learned that there are many different setups for service providers as there are probably service providers. So we had one service provider, for instance, where the customer owned the host, and the host itself was in a different domain than the actual storage side of it, which brings up some challenges. We also saw other ones where customers could only get access to the VMs, there were no self-service, and then we saw other service providers that were just selling services like SharePoint or SQL or other services that for the sector that they were in, where they didn't even need it that. They were just doing it as selling a service on top of it. What we see is SMB3 uses Active Directory, and what we recommend is that the Hyper-V servers and the file servers are actually in the same AD, otherwise you would have writes between them. Also, what we see is storage spaces with JBOD scenarios is that we want you to test that, because there are some things where you have enclosure awareness and you need to have disk majority, so there are some things you need to sit down and test here depending on how many enclosures you want to have in there, and depending on, you should have majority in there, so it depends on how many you want to connect to that cluster at a given point in time. Also, support for ODX and SMIS, where people are using that with virtual machine manager, and they also want to copy files quickly between a VM to another VM, they can do that using ODX without taking those files over the network. Some of them have very good benefits from that, but they were also running into some early issues that were mostly due to partner support of ODX. That has now been fixed, at least for the ones that were using that. So how many of you, if you go back to them, say, how many of you use converged infrastructure today? This one there, this one there. How many of you uses a mix of blades and rack mounted? I'm expecting to see a lot of hands there, yeah, correct. And how many of you only use racks? Okay, that's actually more than I thought, but that makes sense. So what we saw here is that most of the service providers, just like you showed your hands here today, uses a mix of blades and traditional servers. So really what we're seeing here is that fully converged blade scenarios is something that is coming, but not very many are there yet. But it's definitely something people want to go towards. Smaller service providers are also more likely to not go for extreme standardization. They have they probably have more legacy that they cannot get rid of, and they probably are more they probably don't have an easy time to make good deals with hardware vendors and such, so they might want to be forced to switch between different vendors. So that, at least that's what we saw. But also that we see that most of them are provisioning through imaging, not so much PXE booting, but some of them are starting to use that together with Virtual Machine Manager. So if we look at management here, what we see here and what customers really want to do is, of course, service providers live in a world where they're doing things over and over again. Every time they get a new tenant, they will have to go out and do certain things over and over. So automation and standardization is really what they use to drive down that cost. So what we're doing in here when we were talking to them is, first, we talked to them about how they could put together a management cluster in order to help them drive automation and standardization. Then we talked to them about how they could best use Virtual Machine Manager to manage those. Then typically after that, Orchestrator and Operations Manager were tools that they were very interested in. How many of you uses Virtual Machine Manager today? Okay, there's a few hands there. So Virtual Machine Manager is obviously the tool where we're putting more and more things in that it helps you to automate it. First, the where you can provision servers in here, where you can take a blank server, put it into the data center, connect networking, and connect power, and then we can, by using PXE booting, we can load Windows onto it, we can make it join a domain, and then we can actually go in and manage it with Virtual Machine Manager. So that whole process you can fully automate, which many hosts were very interested in because they help them to standardize and automate as much as possible. Orchestrator will typically help them do stuff around that. So after it's been signed into a domain, there needs to be a monitoring agent on it, there needs to be taken backup, there might need to go into a CMDB to get registered. So all that maintenance around it, once you have implemented either a physical host or a virtual host, you use Orchestrator to go around to the different tools, making sure that is up to date. And then obviously, Operations Manager, they wanted to use that to monitor firstly the fabric, and then after that, they might want it to provide monitoring of the VMs that the tenants were using, and then give them access to those alerts. In the second phase, what we typically saw was that they wanted to go and look deeper into WAP, which I will talk about in a minute, and App Controller. And then later on, they were looking at Configuration Manager, Data Protection Manager, and Service Manager as other tools they wanted to use in their stack. So if you go sit down and you read those PLAs, that's another PLA that deals with management. And this tells you how you can put together a management cluster. Because what we don't want to do, we don't want to put all the eggs in the same basket. So in this case, what we do is that we create our fabric cluster where we have all the VMs running. And then next to that, we go in and we create a management cluster that will then handle all the manageability of the first cluster we just created where all the VMs run. We put that together by having a Windows cluster, traditional, where we then put in enable Hyper-V and the VMs between them, and then we put the different management capabilities on top of that. So what we learned on the management side, there's a few things here, that Active Directory is typically a big challenge in the multi-tenant environment, because in most cases, you don't allow trust between the tenant and the backend infrastructure, because that will give a lot of headaches and a lot of things you don't want to happen. So the dilemma with this is that System Center uses ADE to authenticate. You can't get into a System Center products if you can't authenticate and authorize via Active Directory. So what we normally propose is that you keep System Center in the same domain as the actual fabric infrastructure that we created in the first time, because that gives us all the manageability advantages of connecting those two. You will run in, I'm not saying it's not doable, you would just run into a lot of bumps on the way if you start putting those two into two separate domains or forests where there's no trust. So make sure you have that. So what we also see is that when we are talking to customers, of course, SQL plays a very important role in the management infrastructure because all the system center products use SQL. So what we get asked all the time is, should we use SQL always on, or should we, how should we do high availability of SQL? What we normally say here is that if you're in the same, if you're in the same data center, we recommend that you use file over cluster. So if you think about always on, it's really just a list of capabilities that helps you make SQL highly available. So we have a traditional SQL cluster. We also have the availability groups, which many are thinking about what you can do, synchronic and asynchronic synchronization of your databases, which is the one many people want to do. And we say you can do that, you can consider always on, but because it's a new technology, we also want to make sure that you have the right people in the data center that understands how to use that technology and the impacts and the decisions that you make. The other thing is also that there are many different combinations of what we can test using SQL, using SQL Server always on or availability groups and having all the system center products running on top of that. We tested the most common ones, but there are so many different combinations that we haven't tested any shape or form of this. So we don't know it to all the detail down to any combination that you can do of this. So what we're saying is that, yes, we support it. Make sure you test it and make sure that when you use Always On, that you have a person that understands the technology well when you start using it together with the management cluster in here. With the system center considerations, what we have here is a lot of customers use this VMM and orchestrator for the fabric to automate the fabric provisioning of that, configuring the SAN, configuring the network, but also configuring the building up of a physical server that I just talked about. The deployment of the physical servers and networks, they were really focused on doing that because that's where they are using a lot of manual work today in doing those. And since they are having a lot of new servers coming in, a lot of this work, they really want to automate that as much as possible. And then lastly, use performance reporting in Ops Manager is another thing that helped them make better utilization of the actual resources they have available, such as networking, storage, and CPU or compute, so they can spread out their load in a better way, so they can have high identity of VMs on their physical servers. So design patterns for self-service. So there's a few things. How many of you went to MMS? Okay, that's good. Because at MMS, that was the first time we talked about some of the new functionalities that we are coming with in Windows Server 2012. So what we see right here is that we're coming with what we call service providers, and also what we call, I didn't correct it the name, but what we call WAP, the Windows Azure PAP, and app controllers. So what we can do here is that the biggest dilemma, or one of the biggest dilemmas the service providers has, is how do I let a service, how do I let a tenant access data in my backend infrastructure without using AD? How do I authenticate them? And how do I authorize them to make sure that they cannot access data that they're not supposed to access? That's a huge dilemma, first of all, because AD really doesn't support it today in its nature. But also, again, in order to provide self-service, this is a common dilemma that you will see. So what you see right here is that we introduced what we call Service Provider Foundation. So Service Provider Foundation is a new model that we can use to authenticate tenants coming in. And by having this REST data API, where people can go in and ask this web service, by authenticating themselves and saying, I'm this user, I belong to this tenant, we can then go in an automated way and say, if you come in as this user, I would then say you have these rights over in Virtual Machine Manager, where I have then created a tenant group that specifies what I can access in there. The way that we do authentication between App Controller or Windows Azure Pack is using claim-based authentication, where you can then go in via certificate and authenticate yourself via service provider foundations. For those of you that are interested in this, I recommend that you go to Marco Menos and Angeli's session later on this week, where they will go into more details about how this works. One of the very good news about it that will come in R2 is that we will be capable of doing AD federation at that layer as well. So we can actually federate with the actual tenant at the front layer and then map that authorization back into the back end of the infrastructure, mapping that to the tenant, which will hopefully make that a lot easier for you when you try to get new tenants in. All you then have to do is authenticate them with their AD, and then everybody that comes in with that authentication gets mapped to whatever you have specified on the backend, which will hopefully make some of this a bit easier than it is today. How many of you knows about App Controller? Okay. So App Controller is a tool that has been around actually for some years. But what App Controller allows you to do is that you can have different private clouds around. So what you see on the first one is that you have a private cloud there that would typically on-premise. Then you have another private cloud that is a public private cloud, which is typically at a service provider. And then you have the last one, which could be a public one, which could be Windows Azure. So what we want to do here is to provide a tool that gives you one holistic view of all this. So underneath, you can have different hypervisors, both at the private cloud and also at the private public cloud. What we then see is that you can have many different clouds running on top of that with many different applications. But then what we can put on top of that is System Center 2012 App Controller that then gives you insights into what you have access to or the resources that you have in either one of these clouds. So what you can do in App Controller, just really to scratch the surface really quick, is that you can go in there, you can provision new VMs, you can go out and you can stop and start them, you can do traditional maintenance on them, you can scale up, you can upgrade them, and you can also connect them up into Windows Azure. What you can also do in SP1 is that you can take a VM, and then you can actually take that from your own virtual machine manager instance on-premise, and you can take a virtual machine, and then you can move that up into Windows Azure. If you're interested on how to do that, I actually created two blog posts on Building Clouds blog, where I explain step by step how you can actually go ahead and do these steps and move a VM that you have on-premise up into Windows Azure. So what we're also seeing here is the next one, you saw it today, which was the Windows Azure Pack, also formerly known as CATAL. How many of you have heard of Windows Azure Pack? Okay, there's one, okay. So what we're doing here is really coming up, and it's very specialized for service providers. So when Brad Anderson is standing up on stage saying, I would provide a consistent experience across the clouds, one of the key fundamental things he's referring to here is what we call WAP, Windows Azure PAP. So what it will do is that it will allow you to take the same interface and the same capabilities that we're providing in Windows Azure, take that down on-premise, and then it will give you a service management portal with a backend of a service management API, and in that service management API, you can offer different services, such as websites, virtual machines, or other capabilities, databases, and such, and you can also go in and extend it with your own third-party solutions. Parallels, Prender, Cloud Cruiser, and others are already creating extensions for this. Now, why are we doing this? So here you can actually see the different things we can then do. We have websites where we have Windows Server at the bottom, then we have a web farm, and then we hook in this web farm into this service API. So you can go in with this self-service and say, I would like a new ISS website. Could you please provision that to me? And all that is then provided in a management portal. The same thing goes for virtual machines, where you go, I would like to have a new virtual machine. We go in, we contact virtual machine manager, and then that virtual machine then gets provisioned by using virtual machine manager onto a host. And the same thing goes for third-party systems. So really what we're doing here is that we're providing the exact same platform and the learnings we have from Windows Azure, and we are giving this package, the Windows Azure pack, to hosters to allow them to build a similar infrastructure that we have up in Azure and provide this to your customers. What we're doing here is that we use the service management API where we can then allow our customers to access these different services, and then on the back end, lower end, we use Windows Server and System Center to provide those common functions and services that you also see in Windows Azure. So really what we're seeing here is that we have customer solution example that I talked about earlier, just to summarize. So first we went in and we built the fabric together with them. We put up a fabric cluster, we created a fabric network, and then we created the fabric storage. We set up a design based on the converged, non-converged, and SMB3 design patterns. Then we built the management cluster on top of a Windows cluster where we put in virtual machine manager, orchestrator, and operations manager to manage the newly built fabric cluster. On top of that, we then built a WAP, Windows Azure Pack, that allowed the hoster to let their customers access this self-service portal where they can go in and provision their own virtual machines, their own hard drives, and their own websites. And SPF would then authenticate them and give them access to provision the virtual machines into their own private cloud. Then we connected SPF and Windows Azure Pack with the management infrastructure so that could provision the VMs. Then we have the customer using App Controller that could then connect into SPF or connect up to into Windows Azure. So that was kind of the step we took on this journey with these customers. So many customers ask me, or many service providers ask me, what is the difference between App Controller and Windows Azure Pack and SPF? When should I use what? So SPF, you should use that if you have many tenants that wants to access your infrastructure and you want an authentication mechanism to understand what they can get access to and if they can get access and mapping and use it to a tenant and so on. App Controller, you should use that if there is a tenant that has an explicit need for having a view of what they have in their own data center, what they are purchasing from a service provider, and also if they want to see what they have up in Windows Azure, then you can use App Controller. App Controller would also allow you to move VMs from on-premise up into Azure as well. Then if you have Windows Azure Pack, many customers see that as a good jumpstart if they don't already have a portal. Many service providers already has a portal, but they want to be able to use an API that we provide them so they don't have to take care of the authentication and how to reach the actual backend. So the ones that already have a portal already wants to make use of SPF and don't really care that much about the Windows Azure Pack. The ones that are starting from scratch wants to leverage the Windows Azure Pack and build their own features on top of that. So the last thing I want to show you here is really tools that can help you when you go home now and you want to take some of these ideas or at least some of the learnings that I've talked to you about today. So the first one, and this one you can see here, is the infrastructure as a service PLAs. And there's one for the management, and there's one for the fabric architecture. And a lot of that stuff that I showed you today with all the converged and non-converged and all that stuff is in those PLAs. I really encourage you to sit down and read those PLAs because they take you very in a structured manner through the decisions you have to make for storage, for networking, for compute, for management, and all these until you end up and saying, okay, based on all these questions I was asked, I made these decisions. Now I'm advised to go ahead and go out and purchase these things within these boundaries. So there's really good guidance in there, taking you step by step on the way until you actually have a design. Then there's another tool. Many of the service providers we talked to said that they had many instances or many stamps of system centers. So they are actually provisioning new system center tools over and over. So what has been built by a colleague of mine called Rob Willis, he is building a tool called the PowerShell Deployment Toolkit, which is really just an example for how you can automate implementations of software in a complex infrastructure. What we use as an example is actually how you can sit down and you can install all the system center products, including SQL and all the prerequisites that all the system center products uses. And it's a PowerShell script kit where you actually run this and it will go out and even download all the prerequisites out on the internet, put that into a folder, and then you specify on what servers you want to install what system center products and on what SQL server, and then it will automatically start to install this, even going out making a SQL cluster if you want to use that as well. So if you want to install or implement System Center in a standardized way, I really encourage you to look at this PowerShell deployment toolkit. Then we have MS workload deployment. As I said in the beginning, many of the service providers we talk to are looking at providing services to their customers in terms of workloads, Microsoft workloads, such as Lync, such as Exchange, such as SharePoint. And we actually have another example that was created by another colleague of mine, Jim Britt, where he, by using service templates and virtual machine manager and scripting, has fully automated the way that you can provision SharePoint into your infrastructure. So imagine that if you have SharePoint offered as a service, and you want to have an instance per tenant, and you can fully automate that by using virtual machine manager and go to the link that I have down there to help you automate the provision of SharePoint. So this is an example where I don't want you to start from scratch. Go in, look at this, and get some ideas to how you can do similar things to provision Exchange and Lync on top of this. Then the other thing, the last tool that I want to mention here is what we call MAP, which builds on the MVMC automation toolkit. Many of the customers we have are using another hypervisor. So what they want to do here is really to take some of their workloads and migrate these workloads from that other hypervisor over to virtual machine manager, over to the Hyper-V platform. And what MAP can do for you is really to automate this as much as possible, so you can go in and start migrating your VMs from one platform to another without having to do too much manual work. That's a good link there. It's made by Mark Gusson from my team that has used the MVMC and then put a lot of automation on top of that, making it as easy as possible to actually migrate this. So for the related content we have here, there's the automating Microsoft System Center deployment toolkit, which is by Rob Willis that I mentioned earlier. If you're interested in how you can learn how to install System Center in an automated fashion, I encourage you to go and look at that. Migrating from VMware, Mark Gusson has a session about that. If you want to learn how to move those VMs from VMware over to Hyper-V, you can do that. And then enabling on-premise infrastructure as a service solution with the Windows Azure Pack. That is Marco Meno and some of the people that he worked with that has a really good session on that. I'm actually going for that session myself, so I might hopefully see some of you in there. Then some of the stuff that I talked about, both what I blogged about with the moving VMs from on-premise up into Azure, or the stuff that Jim Britt and Mark Gusson and Rob Willis have worked on, you can go in there to blog.technet.com/private-cloud, and you can see all the things there that I described here earlier. And then if you have any questions or you want to come and talk to me about service providers, please come down to the booth. I'm going to be there a lot over the upcoming days, to the Building Cloud booth, where you can come and ask questions, or if you have something that is specific to you and you want to hear if we have done something similar, please come down and talk to us. There are many others for the same team that I work in that are also down in that booth and have a lot of knowledge about service providers and all the stuff we work on. So with that, I really want to encourage you to complete the evaluation. Here is an eval session, and you can use that tag to find the right one. I really encourage you to evaluate this and give me your feedback. I want to have your honest feedback. So let me know what you thought, what I can improve next time, and what you liked and what you didn't like. So with that, I actually want to say thank you very much for your time. I hope you got what you came for, that you learned about how we implemented Windows Server and System Center and the lessons learned we have from talking to these service providers in the field. So thank you very much for your time, and have a great TechEd.